Hello and welcome to the Property Roundup here on iProperty Radio with myself, Carol Tallon, the show where we chat to industry experts to get a view on activity on the ground and to learn about new trends emerging. The show is sponsored by DAF.ie, Ireland's most visited property website. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Susie Nolan, Head of Property with Aviva. Susie, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Carol. It's great to chat.
I'm delighted that you're able to come on to iProperty Radio today, because normally when I have the opportunity to talk to you, it's on a stage or on a panel discussion. And I always love when you're on one of our panel discussions, because you always have a fresh take or an interesting interpretation on the market. And right now, we've just come back from MIPIM in the South of France, where we've heard quite a bit of maybe mixed commentary around the commercial markets. So you might just give me from your perspective with Aviva here in Ireland, you know, where is the real estate market at as we're kind of entering into Q2 of 2024?
Well, it's a tough question, Carol, and I'm sure, as you said, you've heard lots of mixed views. I suppose from my position, I'd start at the kind of more macro level. There's a couple of key economic indicators that I suppose are really playing into real estate, not just here in Ireland, but indeed across wider Europe. Two of the key things I would call out is probably obviously the interest rate. I mean, it goes without saying, we saw obviously a very rapid increase in the interest rates over the past probably 18 months now, from late summer 2022. And that brought with it obviously huge uncertainty. And when, you know, you have institutional investors who are potentially debt-backed buyers, that makes their investment decisions really challenging. And we saw that coming through in the investment stats for 2023, like the lowest level of transaction volumes on record for 10 years. So really low. And I think the interest rate environment had a huge part to play there. I'm really hopeful that H2 this year, we're going to see that starting to come down. So I think we've now stabilized. And even stabilization brings with it a little bit of certainty. So you have stabilization with the view to the interest rate coming down, hopefully later this year. So I do think we're going to see some increase in activity later this year on foot of that. So that would be the one key economic indicator. The other one then being the risk-free rate of return, which is a little bit harder probably to pin down. So when you look at, say, 10-year Irish bonds, for example, you know, they're now producing yields of north of 2.5%. So obviously, if that's your risk-free rate of return, the risk premium that an income yield on property has to give has to provide a decent or an attractive spread for investors. So that one's probably a little bit trickier to pin down in terms of where it's going later this year. But, you know, if it does remain around that 2.5, 2.75 kind of level, then yields are probably going to stay up around where they are now for the kind of prime commercial sectors, you know, between maybe 5, 5.5%. To give that risk premium. And I think that's hugely important. Obviously, then there are the main sectors and how they're performing. And I'm sure we'll get into that, Carol. But, you know, office still brings with it some challenges. And you can see I'm here in my spare room at home. I'm not in the office today. So that hybrid working is bringing continuing challenges.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of interesting things there in what you've said, and I want to unpack those. But let's start with interest rates. You know, I think there seems to be a general expectation that in the second half of the year, we will start to see interest rates coming down. But I suppose the question I have, and I don't know if this is perhaps an unfair question or if it's something you're able to answer, but did the rate hikes do their job? Did they achieve what they needed to achieve over the last kind of 24 months?
I believe they did, Carol, because you can see now, obviously, inflation is slowing. And that's the key, you know, that's the key, I suppose, output of increased interest rates. So I believe that they did. And I think what we've been lucky to achieve here in Ireland is actually we have maintained consumer sentiment. And actually, over the last couple of months, it's actually crept back up again, which is great to see. So look, I think the increased interest rates have served a purpose. Obviously, they have put pressure on the purse strings for individuals, which is never pleasant. But I think at a more macro level, it has served a purpose here, and it has started to slow inflation, which is obviously a positive. And that's the outcome we were looking for here. So I think genuinely, it was, while I didn't like it, it was relatively short lived. So I think we got out, you know, we're getting out of it quicker than maybe I would have expected.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, actually. When we, you know, unfortunately, when we're looking at the stats, we're always looking backwards. So actually, it can be difficult to interpret the trends. But when you talked about the second element there, and that is the risk-free rate of return. And, you know, when we're seeing the yields on 10-year bonds being, you know, anywhere between 2 to 2.75%, you rightly talk about then what that does in terms of the expectations for returns across real estate. But actually, given the marketplace as it is, and look, we can't look across all sectors. So let's just talk about maybe the office market. Is that reasonable then to be able to expect a return north of 5%?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, just obviously given the nature of the asset class, I mean, office or real estate in general, it's an illiquid asset class. There obviously are risks attached to it. There are carry costs attached to it. So there has to be a risk premium there. And if you look back at those 10-year bond rates, I mean, if you go back, there was a few years there where they were zero or even slightly negative. So it's been a huge jump, say, from late 2021 up until the end of 2023, where it went from being pretty much zero to being 2.5%. And so obviously when, you know, if you're looking at investing your cash and you're looking at investing in something that is literally risk-free and can give you 2.5%, that risk premium has to be there. So the spread or the risk premium has to be somewhere around the kind of 2.5% or even a little bit higher, to encourage investors into that space. So I do believe the yields will probably stay up, around that kind of 5, 5.5, say for prime office for the foreseeable when that risk-free rate of return is as attractive as it is.
In the context of risk, not all investments are the same, not all investors are the same. So, Aviva, as essentially a pension fund, what's the attitude towards risk? I suppose, how is Aviva different maybe to other investors in the Irish marketplace?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, as you said, the investor pool is so diverse, Carol, and here in Ireland it's very diverse because you have the likes of ourselves who are pension funds, and then obviously you have institutional investors, you have international investors investing here in Ireland like we have done for years now, and they account for a huge percentage. And all of them have very different risk profiles, even within, I would say, what I'll call our competitor funds, so the other pension funds. Even within that, we have different, say, strategies. So while we might all be investing in similar core sectors like office, retail, and industrial, we would have quite a different approach. So when it comes to Aviva, while it is a pension fund, so being a pension fund, you have to be very risk aware, because this is people's livelihood, effectively, it's their pension money. So you have to be very risk aware. However, what we do, I suppose, a little bit differently is our strategy. We have effectively a strategy pyramid, Carol, and the foundation of that are core assets. Absolutely. So we would typically have maybe 70, 75% of the fund invested in core dry assets that are going to generate good income. And the income profile, obviously, and the quality of the covenant is hugely important. But then as you move up the risk curve, you move up, obviously, the potential reward curve. So we have some assets then always in value add and some in redevelopment. So we like to have that kind of mix. So typically, you'd have about 25% of the portfolio between value add and redevelopment at any given time. And it's kind of a little bit, well, it's a little bit cyclical even within our own portfolio. So for example, I have a core asset, and I won't name any names, but I have a core office asset in the city centre that's going to come vacant later this year. So I know that for a fact. So that's currently sitting in core. It's going to become vacant. So in Q4 of last year, we were already out of the traps, carrying out feasibility studies, looking at what is the highest and best use for that asset. So when it does become vacant later this year, we're ready to go. And I think that that's really important, so that we're not, you know, sitting on vacant stock for too long, and that we're making sure we get the highest and best use. And obviously, with, you know, always through a sustainability lens at the moment as well. So we are very risk aware. So even say when we do redevelopments, Carol, which obviously will be slightly higher risk, if they're a large redevelopment, we do it on I suppose a very risk aware basis, in that we would have a pre-lease in I'd have a pre-lease in my pocket. So, you know, we did a big office development down in Blackrock a couple of years ago, and you know, that was a very, very large development, over 70,000 square foot of office. We had a pre-lease in our pocket. So again, you have to be risk aware because you're a pension fund, but equally, if you don't take risks, the returns aren't going to come through. So definitely taking a little bit of risk has helped drive our performance over the last year or two.
Yeah, actually, the pyramid is a very good way to help maybe understand the investment decisions. But I suppose, again, the investment decisions are essentially one side of it. The other side then is the active asset management piece. So, you know, in terms of, so just for example, you mentioned that one asset you have that you know it's going to be moving from core. So from one of your core investments. So is it your expectation here, and was it kind of the nature of the feasibility studies that were carried out, that this is something that's going to move up the curve into the value add?
So the my current challenge, Carol, is it going to move up into value add or is it going to move up further into redevelopment? So
Okay.
how far up the risk curve are we going to take it? And they're the different feasibility studies we're reviewing at the moment. So we've had them carried out, and I suppose we're just trying to make the decision on which one is the best fit for the fund at the moment, and also in terms of the occupier demand. So, you know, there's potential there to repurpose the building, or is it a, I suppose, a more straightforward refurbishment and relet situation? So that's what we're looking at the moment. So again, and it's balancing with what's going on with other assets in the fund at the same time. But that, you know, that's why we're out of the traps early, is to look at all of the options, and we hope to land on a decision on that one, you know, l later this year. But it's one, I suppose, it's one of 55 assets in the fund. So, you know, we have lots of these decisions. So, like I said, you have to make sure, being a pension fund, that you look at it in its entirety and make sure that a decision we're making over here isn't going to knock something else out of kilter, within the wider portfolio.
And I would imagine if you're moving up that risk curve and you're looking at repurposing, then how does that play into maybe the sector allocations that you have? Because, you know, that's a conversation that we're seeing at the moment, the conversion of buildings from one use to another. So is that something that you've embraced already? Is it something you're just looking at?
So it's something that we would consider in all of our feasibility studies, is that we absolutely look for the highest and best use. So for example, if we have an office, we're not saying it's necessarily going to stay within office. We will consider all options. We have done one or two smaller projects where we have changed the use, and nothing on a very large scale yet, Carol, but it's definitely something that we are considering. I suppose just to come back to the sector allocation piece for a moment. So again, that's somewhere that our fund would be a little bit different than maybe our competitors, in that a lot of competitor funds would have a higher allocation to office. And indeed, the MSCI property benchmark, when you look at the allocations there, we would lag the office ratio in the benchmark quite significantly. But actually, it's something that we have believed in. So we have, you know, a higher allocation to retail, for example. But something that, when I'm talking about retail, and you've heard me talk about this, Carol, is you need to drill down into the subsectors, because actually, high streets versus shopping centres versus retail parks all perform so differently, but yet typically they're all spoken about as retail. Well, because they are retail, but they're all very, very different and they have their nuances. So within our retail, we're diversified across all three of those subsectors of retail, and they have performed very well. And, you know, so that's something that I think, you know, is important, is to have greater diversification across the main sector. So again, being a pension fund, we're somewhat restricted. I can't go out and go long on residential tomorrow, if that's, you know, where my heart took me. I can't do that within the mandate. So I'm a little bit limited in that regard. But I think it's important to have wider diversification. Historically, obviously, people did go long on office, but I think that's now maybe not playing out. Now, who knows what's going to come in the future? And office is that one that's just really hard to call. But I think diversification is really important, and we are absolutely open to repurposing or converting from one use to another within an existing property, if that's what we feel is going to get the best outcome for the customers.
I think retail is a really interesting conversation. And over the past decade and a half, I know the quickest way to irritate somebody about retail is to throw the old retail is dead, you know, a decade ago, at people, because it wasn't true then, it's not true now. And
No.
I think that old kind of throwaway remark came back again during COVID and really was proven wrong. So actually,
Yeah.
can you take us through, because actually I do think, you know, and I'm guilty of talking about retail and meaning it to cover high street shopping centre and the out of town retail parks. But can you maybe give us a breakdown about not just kind of the performance of retail across those kind of three different categories, but maybe your expectations? Because, you know, the same way we're talking about office now is it having maybe a very confusing or unclear future. I think retail was in that position a decade ago, and now we've a little bit of clarity. So maybe what is that clarity that you're seeing on the ground?
So retail is something, Carol, I could talk about all day. So feel free to cut me off. But anyway, so I'm going to look back before I look forward. And as you said, around 10 years ago. So if you go back to the previous cycle, so the previous downturn, let's say, at that time, more than 80% of new retailers taking up space in Ireland were UK subsidiaries. So with that brought huge issues for Ireland in the years that followed. So back in, say, 2010, 2013, 13, 14, that kind of era. Because as I'm sure you're aware, Carol, in the UK, they have a very quick CVA, voluntary administration process. Literally, it can happen overnight. And what happens when, say, a UK retailer goes into voluntary administration in the UK, they literally pull the plug on the Irish sub. And that was happening a lot in the UK because the UK is a completely different retail market. It's heavily overshopped. And when I say overshopped, I don't mean that's me shopping too much. I mean, like in every town in the UK, you would have had a House of Fraser, a Debenhams, a Next, a Marks and Spencers, literally on every street corner. So it was heavily overshopped. So that was a huge problem in the UK, but it had a knock-on impact here. Thankfully, that's no longer the case. Now, less than 20% of new retailers coming into Ireland are UK subs, and we have a much more diverse pool of retailers. And even if you look back, if you look back, say, okay, obviously during COVID, retail had to shut. So unless you were an essential retailer, they had to shut. And thereafter, I think off the top of my head, Carol, I think there's 18 vacant units on Grafton Street. So let's just use Grafton Street as a barometer. And they were units that effectively couldn't reopen after COVID for one reason and another. So they couldn't reopen. So huge vacancy. That then brought with it opportunity, to be honest, for new retailers to enter the market. And we've seen big international brands as well as local Irish brands taking up that space. And now my understanding is that there's only two vacant units and they're actually under negotiation at the moment. So we've come a long way in a short period of time. But the key point is the diversity of the retail base that we now have in Ireland. So the high street, I think, is obviously is hugely important. It's funny when you talk about obviously retail is dead. So I wrote an article in the press in November 2019 about the fact that retail is not dead, and it's about experiential retail, the omni-channel approach being hugely important. And then COVID happened, and I'm like, oh God, now everyone's shopping online. My article is now out of date 2 months later, kind of thing. But actually, it's absolutely not. And I think the comeback post-COVID has really shown that. I mean, I was in Grafton Street the weekend before last. Strolling down Grafton Street, well, strolling, I couldn't because it was mobbed with people, which is great to see. So I think the three different retail subsectors, if I can call them that, have different purposes. So the high street is it brings the experience, as in the as, go meet your friends, go for a stroll with the family. It's a tourist attraction, and yes, people do some shopping there, but they aren't necessarily going into town just to do their shopping and go home again. It is an experience, the atmosphere and everything else. So the high street, in my view, will always have a place. And the likes of, I'm going to take Lego as an example. They're on the high street as a marketing ploy. So you go in there and, you know, you can play with the Lego. You can make a little Lego person that looks just like you and bring it home with you. You're probably not going to buy your huge big box of Lego because then you've got to carry it down Grafton Street. But you'll go home and order it online because you've now seen it in store. Lego doesn't care where you spend your money as long as you're spending it on Lego. So that's the omni-channel approach. And that's really the place of the high street is that kind of marketing, experiential retail, omni-channel approach. The shopping centre, I think, and obviously shopping centre locations and accessibility is hugely important, so they aren't all the same, but they bring with it, you know, things that you can't get online. So it's the services as well. So the tenant mix within a shopping centre is hugely important. And I'm not going to go into too many Aviva properties, but say take Blackrock Village Centre, for example, that we recently redeveloped. And we've been letting that up. And yes, we have one or two vacant units left. But it's because as a landlord, this is a long-term play for us. We want to make sure we have the right mix of tenants. So while we could have had, you know, a couple of different, you know, beauty operators in there, that didn't make sense. You know, we have one or two, that's all we need. So it's not about getting the tenants in quickly, it's about getting the right tenants in and providing things like, you know, the pet stop has just gone in. I think so many people got pets during COVID, myself included. But pet stock, you know, pet food, that kind of thing is something you need quickly. You need to have that in your local shopping centre. So I think the shopping centre has a place for, you know, I'm going to call it like a services and amenities as well as somewhere you go just to shop. And that's really important. So the tenant mix, I think, is hugely important in shopping centres. And as I said, the accessibility point. And then obviously the retail parks are different. Now, retail parks were hugely popular in COVID because actually a lot of them stayed open. Well, they stayed open in the very nature and that they're open air. And actually they're all own door shops. So if you're an essential retailer, and most essential retailers actually occupy retail parks, like your electronic goods stores, again, your pet food stores, they stayed open during COVID, and which was beneficial in its own right because you didn't have that stop and trade. But actually they're just something again that everybody needs. So you're not going to buy, well, I don't know, do people buy carpet online? But you're not going to buy carpet online. You're probably not going to buy your couch online because you want to sit on it. So again, retail parks will always have a place. And again, you can see the appetite from investors for retail parks because they do generate a higher yield than the high street. So it's a slightly higher yield on the high street, typically long leases and good quality covenants. I mean, the likes of your Grafton Group, you know, who's an anchor in many of the retail parks, you've got good quality covenants, and you know, they're fully occupied. The demand from occupiers is really important as well.
You know, I think it's interesting to hear you chart that journey. And you know, now that you say it, I suppose it makes sense. But actually, I hadn't really understood or even paid attention to the fact that, you know, that transition that happened over 10 years, I wouldn't have thought the figure was as high as 80% UK subsidiaries coming in. But actually, to see that turnaround, that's an entire transformation of a whole sector. So that's really interesting. But I suppose taken from the experiential and the omni-channel and taking the lessons from retail, knowing the journey it's been on for the last decade, are there any lessons here that we could apply to the office market and maybe keeping experiential, but you know, changing omni-channel to maybe hybrid? Are there lessons for
Absolutely.
the office market?
Absolutely, Carol. I firmly believe that there are. And actually, I think the word experiential is hugely important because, you know, so as I said, you can see I'm sitting at home here today. I'm sitting at home here today. Well, firstly, to have this interview, so I'm not having people walking up to my desk. But also, you know, I've got reports to do today. When I go into the office, there is a certain experience that I'm getting in the office that I can't get at home. And that is physical in-person meetings, it's the collaboration, it's the literally just going for lunch with my colleagues and, you know, shooting the breeze that you can't do over Teams. But I think what's also important for employers now in order to attract people back to the office, because I think I don't think anybody disputes the benefits of having your people in the office at least a couple of days a week. So I think that's acknowledged at this stage. But there needs to be a hook. They need to know, well, why is it worth my hour-long commute, for example? You know, what's in it for me? And that's the key point, I suppose. What's in it for me? And it's the experience. So obviously all those meetings and everything are great, but do you have wellness spaces in your offices? Do you have communities? Do you have, and I'm quite passionate about the DEI, the world of DEI, the diversity, equity, and inclusion piece. Do you have communities where your people can feel a part of when they come into the office? Another good example is that office in Blackrock. And, you know, I'm not speaking out of school here. This is public knowledge, I suppose. But when the initial plans went in for that building, the top floor has beautiful views over Dublin Bay. And originally, pre-COVID, that floor was going to be the exec floor, which would have been very normal that the execs got the top floor with the beautiful views. And by the time fit out came, which was during COVID, they decided, you know what, this actually should be a floor that's open to our entire workforce. So now it's their amenity space where they have their canteen and everything else and some breakout areas. So everybody gets to enjoy the views. And I think that's the key is, I suppose, in terms of hybrid, yes, you know, being at home has its merits for individuals, but I think to encourage people back to the office, that hybrid or omni-channel approach or the experience, there needs to be a what's in it for me. For most people who you're kind of trying to encourage them back to the office, maybe they don't see the benefits just yet, but to encourage them, there needs to be an experience piece there more than just sitting at a desk and putting a headset on. I can do that at home. Why am I in the office?
You know, I love that without us having to introduce the topic of ESG, you've actually shown me what that is in action, which that's the way it should be. It's not a separate subcategory. It's something that should be the ethos of how you approach not just the investment decisions, but also kind of the active management piece, but also how you're spending your time and within your office and colleagues. So, and actually, I really love that. With the ESG, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine when people automatically jump to sustainability. I know that's a huge piece, and I feel that's, you know, we have some very strong economic and regulatory drivers there making sure that that happens. The social piece is that, you know, to me, that's the magic sauce. That's the magic bit that actually is going to be whether this works out. And I think experiential flows a little into that, but a little bit like the office block you described there, what might have been typically the executive floor now becomes the people's floor. And that doesn't just tie into the experience of staff going in there at teams going in on a daily basis. Actually, that actually is providing for the social element that you want. And sometimes the social element of commercial, the social placemaking element has been a little bit behind the curve maybe than what we would have seen in residential. So I love that you've introduce that without us even having to label it as ESG, because to my mind, it should be just how we operate. Like technology should be just integrated through every part of what we're doing. But in terms of social inclusiveness, I think this is maybe I think that you might be too modest to say it, so I don't mind saying it. But before we came on air, I made the point that actually I love Aviva's tagline. As somebody who is into branding, not just of companies but of places as well, I think Aviva, it takes a village. It takes Aviva. It is so beautiful. It takes Aviva. It is just a perfect tagline for social inclusiveness, apart from anything else. So talk to me a little bit about the brand, because by the way, this is very remiss that I'm only mentioning this at this stage of the interview, but of course Aviva won Asset Manager of the Year 2024 in the National Property Awards in conjunction with the Business Post, and of course iProperty Radio was the radio partner for that. So congratulations to you and the team on winning Asset Manager of the Year for 2024.
Thank you.
But like all achievements in business, that was last week, so that's last week's news. So this
Fair.
week, no, it is always the way. So this week, let's talk about what, how that brand, it takes Aviva, it takes a village. How does that translate on the ground? What does that look like in terms of your ESG strategy?
Absolutely. And I'm just going to touch on one point that you made that I just totally resonates with me, Carol, first. I just think people use ESG and sustainability interchangeably. And often they think that the S stands for sustainability. And I'm like, no, it does not. It's social. And ESG has three components. Sustainability is only actually the E part. So no, the social part is something that's close to my own heart, but also close to the Aviva brand. And you've touched on it there. It takes Aviva at a very high, I suppose, global level, because obviously Aviva being a global PLC, it really is that kind of a takes a village approach. And I'm saying that genuinely. I really believe it. You look at things like, let's bring it local here in Ireland. So obviously we sponsor the stadium and that will be very well known, but we use that as well, to the benefit of the community. So like we run Soccer Sisters. So we give young girls the chance, to play soccer with some soccer stars over some summer camps. We work with some big kind of charity partners. I think that's hugely important at a corporate level. Obviously, without getting into too much into sustainability, we're on our path ourselves to be net zero by 2040. So we were the first and the biggest insurance company to come out with that goal. So, and we're all playing into that. But the social piece, I think, is hugely important. And I suppose when you look locally at what myself and my team are doing, so obviously, commercial property landlord, 55 properties in Ireland, mainly in Dublin. Naturally, we have some vacancy. Landlords don't tend to like to have vacancy, but sometimes you have strategic vacancy where you're on a planning journey, or potentially you just have some vacancy where you're literally just trying to let up the space. And that's quite natural. And I think all landlords will acknowledge that. So what we have done, and it actually started, would you believe, at the start of COVID. So we don't really have residential only when it's an ancillary, but we have a couple of residential units in the city centre above a shop. And the House the Heroes campaign came out. So we gave whatever residential units we could to the House the Heroes campaign to get doctors into the city, obviously in the height of COVID. And that just kind of got the cogs turning. And I was like, well, where else can we do this? What, where else can we use our vacant properties to the benefit of the community? So there's a, I mean, there's a couple of really good, I suppose, examples of that at the moment too, that I'm I suppose very proud of. And one is down in Blackrock in the shopping centre, above the shopping centre, we built a couple of three new floors of office space. And they finished maybe about 18 months ago. And we're obviously on that letting journey now. Two of them have been let. So again, you never hear about the lettings in the market at the moment, but we have two really good lettings down there. So Fahmy and Dunport are in there in two of the floors. And the third floor is still vacant. And obviously we are actively letting that floor. And absolutely, I need to get that let up. But while it is vacant, we have provided that floor on a rent-free basis to Neurodiversity Ireland, not to use as an office, because actually that floor actually specifically has, it can be office or leisure use. So Neurodiversity Ireland are in there running a soft play centre for neurodivergent children, which I just think is fabulous. Those kids can't go to the likes of a Funky Monkeys or a normal play centre. It's too much for them. So this area has a soft play centre, sensory rooms, they have dance classes that just meet their needs. And to be honest, it's a fabulous thing to be able to do. Obviously, I'm actually trying to let that space in the background, and that's the agreement with Neurodiversity Ireland is when I get a paying tenant coming in, we will then give them 3 months' notice and they will vacate. But for now, why not use that space for the betterment of the community? It also then, selfishly from a landlord's perspective, brings additional footfall to the shopping centre and puts the shopping centre on the map. And then similarly, we have Dublin Pride are in one of our units on Clarendon Street. And originally they took that on an 18-month license on reduced rent. And they were using it as the Pride hub. And effectively, most of that meant they were selling kind of Dublin Pride merchandise and giving out information and that kind of thing. But it's been so successful that they have now also partnered with Belong To, the Dublin Youth Foundation for LGBTQ plus children, teenagers, who now have a safe space to go in there and talk and meet as a community. Whereas their previous location was in maybe a less good part of Dublin, if I can say that. And those teenagers going in there used to get heckled every day of the week going in there. And now they have a much safer space to go in. So look, I just think where you have vacancy, if you can use it for the betterment of the community, that's something that I think, again, it just, you know, it does resonate with the brand, but personally, it's something that I think is really important.
That's one of the things that is I genuinely think is remarkable that you're doing. But I want to deal with some of the resistance that I think maybe other asset managers listening in or other property owners listening in today might have. I think meanwhile uses is the ultimate in sustainability. You know, a community benefit, and the use can be varied. So you've mentioned some really great things there, but there's so many different uses for a meanwhile use, but developers would certainly have a fear of meanwhile uses because going back over past decades where they might have made a building available for a meanwhile use for a community centre, and then when it's time to vacate, the community have been up in arms not wanting to vacate, and they've run into issues and challenges. So, can you address maybe some of the resistance around meanwhile uses? That and how those have been overcome.
It is, I can understand the resistance, Carol, and it's something obviously we thought long and hard about. And also, again, being a pension fund, the perception that this might give that, you know, I'm giving away space for free and I'm not out there actively trying to rentalize the space. So, you know, rest assured we're trying to rentalize the space or bring a property on its planning journey or whatever it might be in parallel. But I think it's that, as you say, the meanwhile space is so important. But it is about having the upfront conversation. And to be honest, what we've done is obviously legally documented everything. And again, in that wider ESG world, there are so many lawyers out there that are very willing to do pro bono work. So when it comes to something like this, we have partnered with lawyers who are willing to do pro bono work to legally document these rent-free or reduced rental licenses with the community. So then everybody's on the same page and there's no, I suppose, ambiguity. And we keep a very open, I suppose, channel of communication with the likes of Neurodiversity Ireland. So there's no, I suppose, confusion or ambiguity around what their future is. And I think that's really important that it's a two-way street, very open communication. And if there's ever an issue on either side, which thankfully there hasn't been yet, it's raised. You know, we just raise it very quickly because we have those close relationships ourselves. We tend to, even where we have a multi-let property and we have a property manager, to be honest, myself and my team have direct relationship with the tenants. And I think that's really important. It is that old Irish relationship piece is so important. Like it can bring challenges. It's not easy. And, you know, one or two people have said to me, oh God, why would you bother with that effort? You're not getting anything out of it. I'm like, well, maybe I'm not technically getting anything out of it, but the community is. And you know what? I just think that's so important and take that little bit of extra trouble. Yes, it's taken, say, an asset manager on my team, it's taken a bit of their time to get these deals over the line where they could have maybe been focusing on something else. But again, I just think for the betterment of the community and to use those vacant properties is important for everybody. And you know, I think the challenges are easily overcome if you kind of put your mind to it, to be honest.
Yeah, look, I wholeheartedly agree. So I really hope out of everything else we've discussed today that that's one of the key takeaways for any property owners, any local authorities and any asset managers who might find themselves in a similar position. I'm very conscious of your time today. So before we finish up, I want to look ahead maybe for the expectations that you have for real estate over the next kind of 12 to 24 months. But let's start with as we're going to be looking at the future, let's start with the immediate future. Only in the last few days, the Irish Times was reporting on some leases that new leases that your team have gotten over the line, particularly in Leeson Street. And I think maybe that's an example of taking us back to our earlier conversation around that that pyramid the pyramid where you were maybe taking assets that might have been core assets and that maybe was a value add. So you might just very quickly kind of talk us through those particular deals and maybe what your expectations are then for over the next 12 to 24 months.
Absolutely, Carol. And I suppose one thing that I find is that, you know, sometimes the letting activity doesn't hit the paper, and people might have, and understandably, a negative or a skewed outlook on office at the moment. And absolutely, it's really, really difficult sector. It's really hard to predict where it's going to go, because obviously companies are still only maybe approaching lease events since COVID. You know what I mean? Because COVID still isn't even 5 years in the rearview mirror yet. So we still have a lot of that activity coming through now. But I suppose what we have seen is, if you can adapt as a landlord, so be open to different types of lease structures. Prior to COVID, it would have been 15 years with a break of 10. Be open to maybe different lease terms. Obviously, then there's a quid pro quo. You might get a higher rent per square foot if you're willing to give an earlier break. And I think that kind of thing is critical. So not to rule things out as a landlord. But the other key thing, and 18 Lower Leigh Street's a really good example of it, and the strategy pyramid really comes into play here. So that would have been when it was let. It would have been in the core part of our strategy pyramid. It became vacant. We then brought it all the way up, actually probably towards the top, into redevelopment, because we brought it on quite a journey in terms of greening the building. So it's now LEED Gold and B or A3 rated building. And we also added about 5,000 square foot in kind of a glass structure to the rear of the building. And then, when that was completed, it was available to let. And again, conscious of the market, we took the approach that it was going to be a multi-let building, so kind of owned that from the start and set it up to be such, so with your BMS systems and everything else, so that it is ready to be a multi-let building. Because what we're seeing now is demand for kind of smaller floor plates or even multi-stack leases, where somebody, a tenant, might come in and take two floors, but they want one floor, say, for 5 years and the other floor for 7 years or something like that. So again, we set it up as a multi-let building, and we have two really good quality tenants in there already. So we have Falco and Lockton have each taken a floor, and we're now close to terms on the third floor as well, which is fantastic to see. Again, at very strong rents. With all the negative sentiment out there in the office space, I suppose my key message is it's about having the right space, being open to different types of negotiations than we used to do pre-COVID, and that's the key piece, I think. But it is absolutely about the quality of the space, and I know. Sustainability you touched on is talked about every day of the week at the moment, but that is critical to attract the right quality covenant, which from my perspective as a pension fund is hugely important. The covenant is so important. You have to deliver the good quality space. And then I touched on a couple of lettings down in BlackRock as well. So suburban office isn't an easy sector at the moment, but again, two really strong lettings down there to FAMI, which is the treasury arm of IKEA, and to Dunport Capital. So strong lettings, and then we've some smaller lettings taking place in our smaller offices across the city in recent months as well. So, we've CSR and Dayton, and really good tenants coming into the properties. So I do think it's about having the conversations as a landlord, not being afraid to look at a different type of structure to your lease or different maybe tenant incentives that weren't there before. Obviously, making sure it makes sense for both parties, but being open to having those conversations.
And what are your expectations of it? Like, it's great to see the negotiations that are in train, the leases that have gotten over the line, and but I suppose strategically, what are your priorities maybe over the next 24 months?
So specifically in the office sector, Carol? Yeah, so in
Across.
yeah, I mean, I suppose in the office sector, that we're on a journey like all other landlords in terms of being aware of properties that are coming vacant in the next few years. And you touched on earlier, the various new legislation that's coming through, and making sure that we can adhere to that. So it's obviously landlord kind of legislation coming through, but also in terms of occupancy. So say, the public sector will only be able to occupy buildings of certain B or ratings going forward. So I suppose getting ahead of that, having that all mapped out, and mapping out our properties and their vacancies as they come, and make sure we know what we're going to do. And is it a case that we're going to green that building, or is it a case that we're going to repurpose that building, for example? So I suppose that's the key, is be ahead of it, be on top of the legislation, and know your own milestones within your portfolio to make sure you're mapping the legislation onto that. Retail, I do think, is really coming back. And I think that's a sector that's seeing a lot of occupier demand and investor demand. So that's one that I think is certainly one to watch. Obviously, industrial has continued to be strong throughout. Personally, I think it's probably a little bit expensive at the moment, but that's the supply demand imbalance. You're always going to see that. So, I just think landlords need to be more flexible and more open to different types of lease structures than what we've seen in the past.
Very good. Susie, I always learn so much. Every time I have the opportunity to talk to you, whether it's on a panel or otherwise, I always learn so much. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And actually, from the perspective of what you and your team are doing, I think you're showing genuine, true leadership actually in some of the initiatives, particularly across ESG, the social inclusion. and those meanwhile uses. So again, if there's one really key takeaway from today's interview that I hope others follow your lead on, it will be that. So thank you so much for taking the time to go through that with us today. That was Susie Nolan, Head of Property with Aviva. My thanks as always to producer Katie Tallon and to the production team at Hear Me Roar Media. Also, huge thanks to our show sponsor, daft.ie, Ireland's most visited property website. And also thank you indeed for tuning in. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Property Roundup. In the meantime, please be sure to check out all of the other Irish and international real estate and construction shows on iPropertyRadio.com.